The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome everyone, and welcome Ajahn Chandoko. Nice to have you back. This is Ajahn Chandoko's, I believe, fourth visit to the center, and I feel like we're very fortunate to have somebody who's actually from Minneapolis originally, but who did something that not too many people do, which is become part of an ancient tradition in Thailand, in this case, and participated in a style of practice that is really modeled after the way the monks and nuns practiced at the time of the Buddha. It's called the Thai Forest Tradition, and it's a lineage or a school of Buddhism in Thailand. And practiced at Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Khanana Chah, that was set up for Westerners practicing in this traditional way back in 1990. So for 18 years now, Ajahn Chah, of course, practiced as a monk and had done some practice prior to that as well. And so we get this rare opportunity, somebody who is just a Minnesota guy, and at the same time has really devoted his life to this practice that is quite transforming. And we just, many of us in this room, just finished an 8-day retreat to Ajahn Chandoko up north. A really wonderful opportunity to hear these teachings and just to be together in the practice. So I look forward to Ajahn Chandoko's talk tonight. And if you'd like to find out more about Ajahn Chandoko and the monastery that he leads, his abbot of in New Zealand, there's, I think Dennis put out the website there on the table. You can copy it down if you want. A lot of talks and interesting Buddhist resources at that website and links to other places. So it's worth checking out. And maybe Ajahn Chandoko, at the end of the talk, will speak a little bit about his plans, Minnesota plans. Thanks again, Ajahn Chandoko, for coming.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I always feel honored to come here to Common Ground because I really have a lot of respect for what Mark and everyone of this whole community has put together. And I can see how it's been developing over the years. And it is very inspiring and encouraging. When I was here in Minneapolis and interested in Buddhism, you know, you had to look pretty hard to find something. It was really one place at that time. And now it's just so encouraging to see it growing, sprouting, and thriving in many, many different neighborhoods.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami.
So there is peace in the world. And generally, when there is peace in the world, we consider it good. But peace in the world is subject to arising and passing away, as we know very well. So then there's peace in the world, and then there's unshakable peace. Now the peace which is unshakable doesn't arise and doesn't pass away. When the Buddha realized for the first time the truth of the Dhamma, it was like he discovered an ancient city, or it was as if he had plugged into something which was there all the time, an unshakable peace. Now, whether Buddhas arise or not arise, whether we're in a bright era or a dark era, the Dhamma remains the same. The Dhamma remains unshakable, peaceful. So tuning into the Dhamma is what it's all about, what we're aiming for, what we're encouraging, what we're investigating. But what is the Dhamma? We take refuge in the Dhamma as one of the three refuges. Dhammam saranam gacchami. But what actually is the Dhamma? The words in the suttas, what we hear in Dhamma talks, what we read in books, in the books stores and the Buddhist section, and the Dhamma is really nature, and the laws according to nature, and living in harmony with the laws that are in accordance with nature, and bringing that into our lives. In the forest tradition, we try to take nature as our primary teacher. Above and beyond everything else, it really comes down to studying nature. You go out, you sit underneath a tree, you sit in the forest, go out on the mountains, go into the cave, sit by a stream, just watch the stream. How does water flow? How does water work? Which is stronger, the rocks or the water? We're mostly water. If we can understand water, then kind of get a handle on how we work too. We understand how trees grow, being out in the forest. You get healthy, thriving, beautiful trees, but you also get dead trees and decaying trees and new trees sprouting out. And when a storm comes through, which trees survive and which trees don't survive? Getting close to the elements. And this is what the Buddhist teachings are meant to be based on. When the Buddha talked about the Dhamma and taught the Dhamma and verbalized it, then he did the best he could. He probably did the best any human being could in creating words, teachings, and a way of life which pointed to nature, pointed to the ultimate truths of nature, the unshakable peace behind nature. But of course, the words themselves are not the end. So we take refuge in the Dhamma, and it's part of what we can reflect on. What is it that we're actually taking refuge in? What does it mean to take refuge in the Dhamma? Well, in the forest tradition, we try to stay close to the elements of nature. Recently, we had a retreat up in northern Minnesota, and we were really close to the elements, as anyone who's been on the retreat can attest. We didn't just have retreatants, we had Dhamma warriors. And they were close to the earth element, living in tents on the ground, and they were close to the water element, bathing in lake water and feeling the rain. And they were close to the wind element a lot. As we got some big strong winds coming through, and they were definitely close to the fire element. We had one of the most intense electrical storms that most of us have seen in a long, long time. And there's a liveliness or a primacy about being close to the elements. It's a kind of a learning that takes place which doesn't necessarily have to engage the intellect so directly. You kind of feel it. You sit by a big tree, or sit by the lake, and just, what does it feel like in your gut? So there's a certain amount of learning that takes place, just being immersed in nature. Of course, nature is, and the laws of nature are happening even in the midst of downtown Minneapolis. But somehow, with all the concrete and steel girders, it's like man's ego, the human ego, tends to be predominant or be more obvious. Or if you're just out in the wilds, then it's just our own ego, which is predominant and it stands out. And then it becomes really clear what the obstacles are between unshakable peace and the current present circumstances. So what is the Dhamma? These days in Buddhism, we are present in an age which is, it's really unprecedented in the history of Buddhism. 2,500 years. There's never been a time where we have access to all different traditions simultaneously. So this is a great opportunity. It's also a great opportunity for confusion. If you have just one cereal to choose from, it's very easy to be happy with one box of cereal. But if you have 50, then you just start to fall into choice paralysis. Follow your childhood love of Raisin Bran, or just follow your kind of chelation and go for Fruit Loops, or just try to be natural and go for the granola. But if you just have Raisin Bran, then it's easy. And for most of the history of Buddhism, most of the countries or societies where it has thrived has essentially just had one main type of Buddhism. And that's always been good enough. That's always been adequate to produce very wise people. You just take one box of cereal and throw yourself into it and get enough nutrition. But how do we judge what is the Dhamma and what isn't the Dhamma? What is the Dharma? However you want to spell it. So in many ways, the Buddha didn't just give direct pat answers. He would give guidelines. Even when he was asked, do enlightened individuals occur, are they to be found in other traditions besides the teachings of the Buddha? And he didn't just say yes or no or give a straight answer. He said, in any tradition that you find the Eightfold Path, you will find people on the stages of enlightenment. There was another time where the Buddha's mother, really stepmother, came to him. Now the Buddha was born in the forest, and shortly after that, his mother passed away, approximately a week after he was born, which was really heartbreaking to Suddhodana, the Buddha's father. But the Buddha's aunt was also there in the palace, part of the royal scene. And so she then took over the role, raising the young Siddhartha. Her name was Mahaprajapati Gotama. And for all intents and purposes, she was actually the Buddha's mother, except biologically. She weaned him, she raised him. And a few years after the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, passed away. Now, there was a happy ending to that, even though he had great initial doubts about the Buddhist path. He did apparently die a fully enlightened being. And shortly after that, Mahapajapati, she decided that she would also like to lead the life of a wandering holy person. So she asked the Buddha for going forth. And she was really willing to go for it. In order to show her dedication to that, she walked a huge distance with a great following of other women and arrived swollen feet, sore, worn out, covered with dust, to where the Buddha was staying, and please asked for the going forth, the ordination, the inclusion into the ordained monastic sangha. So the Buddha's stepmother then was the very first nun. It was a family business. And there was a time later on in her period of being a nun where she came to the Buddha and she said, I would like to go into seclusion to practice more intensively. I'd like to go into a place which is withdrawn from the larger monastic sangha, a place where I can be alone, a place where I can practice diligently. Can you please, Blessed One, give me a short teaching on what is the Dhamma? So the Buddha addressed his stepmother and he said, now there are certain qualities which lead to the Dhamma, and there are certain qualities which you can be assured of are leading away from the Dhamma. And then he gave eight pairs of guidelines. And these eight pairs of guidelines are still valid today. So the first pair are passion and dispassion. He said those things which are leading to passion, you can be assured that they are not the Dhamma. And those things which are leading to dispassion, you can be sure that they are the Dhamma. And so what do we mean by passion and dispassion? The Pali is raga, viraga. So by passion we're referring to not passion in the positive sense of the word, so not in the sense of having enthusiasm for something, but in the sense of an unquenchable thirst, seeking through the senses in a way which can never lead to satisfaction, and just an endless quest to find beauty through sight, beautiful sounds, wonderful smells, delicious tastes, comfort. So, when passion manifests itself through the senses, then it can lead into a situation which is inherently unsatisfactory, unquenchable desire. So dispassion, or viraga, is the cessation of those hungers and thirsts. Dispassion. It's one of the most important steps on the path to enlightenment. In one of the classic series of causes and conditions, happiness leads to samadhi, deep peace, and samadhi then leads to seeing things as they truly are. And seeing things as they truly are leads to the fading away and cessation of passion. Which leads to full enlightenment. So true dispassion is a very profound thing. And the Buddha said, anything which is leading in the direction of true dispassion, you can be assured that this is the Dhamma. Now the second pair was attachment and detachment, or letting go. So attachment is a word we hear a lot about in Buddhist circles. And generally, attachment is considered to be the cause of dukkha. Really, it's craving and clinging, which together we could call attachment, holding on, possessiveness, identification with things, holding things very tightly, holding things so tightly to the point where we tend to squeeze the life out of them. And that's what real possessiveness is, and how possessiveness can kill even the most joyful and wonderful things in our life just through excessive clinging. So those things which are leading towards this attachment, this bondage, is another way of translating it, bondage. You can be assured that those things are leading away from the Dhamma. And those things which are leading to freedom or letting go, to detachment in a positive sense, but sense of being freed from bondage, being liberated. And that's leading to the Dhamma. The third pair is accumulation. That which is leading to accumulation, getting more and more and more, and you know, I mean, this is what America is all about. So the opposite of that is getting rid of things. That's almost un-American. It's not good for the economy. But how much do we need, really, this idea of accumulation? And it's not just accumulation or amassing of material things and money and possessions and cars and houses and clothes, and it's all the things we mentally accumulate, our personalities, our identifications, our statuses, our, you know, everything that we build up and hold on to as being me and mine, and put together this whole amassing of everything, physical, mental, emotional. So the more we amass and accumulate and all of that, the Buddha said this is actually leading away from the Dhamma. And what is it that's leading towards the Dhamma? It's this sense of diminution, actually letting things go, getting rid of things, setting things down. So it's not just material things sometimes, but it's really how we relate to things, because you can't just get rid of everything. We need certain things to survive, and it's not a matter of just getting rid of external things and thinking that we're free of attachment. But it's really how we relate to things, even when we keep them in our lives. People say, "Ah, John, I'm attached to my children, so you're saying I should get rid of my children." I said, "Yes, that's right." "No," I said, "but you don't kick your children out of your house. But the whole relationship can be based more on, say, freedom, dispassion, liberation, lack of bondage, lack of holding and clinging, lack of attachment, not amassing, letting go." So it's interesting to see how these things relate to how we live, how we're used to living in a particular society. the Dhamma is not designed to go with the mainstream. If it was, then getting enlightened would be easy. But the Dhamma always goes against the mainstream of the world. The next pair is aggrandizement. Self-aggrandizement and modesty or humility, like true humility. So anything that's leading to a gigantic ego, or anything that's just leading to reinforcing our sense of self, or aggrandizing it, solidifying it, making it entrenched in the world, then that's going to be leading away from the Dhamma. And anything which is leading towards just being very modest and humble. By humble, we don't mean say being very hard on oneself, or giving oneself a hard time, or thinking that we're worthless. It's not the opposite of conceit. In Pali, the word conceit doesn't just mean what we normally think of as conceited, like, I'm so great. But conceit refers to also not just I am better than you, but also I am worse than you. You are worse than me. You are better than me. Or we are the same. Any idea of self compared with others is considered conceit, because it's based on a sense of self, identifying with the sense of self. And the more we put energy into that, the more solid it becomes, then the more it's actually leading us away from the Dhamma. So true humility is not, oh, I'm no good, you know, there's nothing special about me. True humility is just getting the self out of the way. The next pair is discontent and contentment. So we tend to think of contentment as hopefully the end of the path. And why are we doing all this? Well, whatever we're doing, hopefully it's leading to contentment. Even if it's material accumulation or amassing wealth or self-aggrandizement, hopefully, you know, the idea is that it's leading to contentment. Although after a while, we tend to learn that it doesn't work very well. But even on the Buddhist path, we can think that, oh, well, contentment is the end of the path, but the process to get there is going to be a real hard slog. It's going to be really painful, and the more pain it is, probably the more holy I am. So I'll be really hard on myself. And I won't be content until I'm fully enlightened. I vow not to be content. But if you find that you want to take meditation deeper, one of the greatest tools, really the only way to take meditation deeper and deeper and deeper, is to be totally content with exactly how it is right now. Not trying to force it, change it, strive for something different, but be totally content with the way it is right now, just focusing in on that contentment, absolutely, perfectly content, and then you'd be surprised it actually goes deeper. So contentment is not something that is just the result in the end of the path, but it's a quality that we can develop moment by moment. And that's good to investigate. Now, what is content and what is discontent? Because, you know, really, contentment means that we have the ability to be absolutely perfectly happy right here and right now. And if we're not absolutely perfectly happy right here and right now, then we're experiencing discontent. And what is it? You know, what is it? You know, desire, trying to get rid of something, uncomfortable feelings, emotions, whatever. It all kind of fits into the content. Even if we're just bored, And if we were perfectly content, even if we're just sitting doing nothing for hours on end, which we do a lot of that, then we'd be perfectly content. There would be no boredom arising whatsoever. But if you've been on retreats, and especially in the beginning, for the first 20 years maybe, then sometimes boredom arises. Another period of sitting. Oh gosh, this is so boring. But what actually is it that's boring? It's just a very subtle discontent with the way things are right here in the present moment. And with a slight switch of perception or attitude, it's like discontent or boredom can just be turned into, hey, actually everything's just fine the way it is right now. So anything which is leading to discontent is considered leading away from the Dhamma. Anything which is leading to contentment is considered the Dhamma. The next pair is entanglement in society and seclusion. Now, disengaging from entanglement in society doesn't mean that we all have to run away to a monastery. But if you do, that's fine. I can recommend some good places. However, it's really the attitude which is most important. We can be engaged in many different relationships within our lives and still be unentangled, have a feeling of not being entangled in it all. Or we might have just one relationship and feel totally entangled. Or we may not have many relationships with other people at all, but we just have relationships with our own mind, and then we're totally entangled in that. So anything which is leading to entanglement is going to be leading away from the Dhamma. One of the similes that the Buddha would use talking about his generation, to say nothing of our generation, you know, I don't know what he'd say about our generation, but even his generation, he'd say, you know, he would be thinking, the Dhamma is such a refined thing. Like after he was enlightened, he hesitated. Is there going to be anyone who's going to understand this? Such a refined thing. This generation is like a tangled ball of string. It's just like a massive string that's all tangled and knotted. And that was his simile for our minds. And Dhamma practice is like untangling it all. And you wonder, well, why does it take so much time to practice the Dhamma? You say, well, it's kind of like you've got this big mass of thread that's all knotted, and you just have to very carefully, mindfully, persistently, you know, with wisdom, and you have common sense, kind of see, okay, well, this is hooked around this loop, and this is tied here, and this needs to be unknotted, and okay, we get a bit of free thread here, we'll keep that nice and straight, and then we're going to work on this section. And so that's a bit like Dhamma practice, disentanglement, disentangling our minds. And you can't just go into a big tangle of thread and just try to force it straight, because then it just rips and breaks. So it takes delicate persistence. It takes observation. It takes intelligence. You gotta see, okay, well, this is where it's tangled. See, and then use your intelligence to undo it. So that which is leading to disentanglement is the Dhamma. Now, another way of phrasing that is seclusion. And this is a quality that the Buddha encouraged a lot. Seclusion. Now, very few of us really have the opportunity to go off into real seclusion very often. But even if we have the opportunity to go on retreat periodically, it's worth doing. Even if we don't have the opportunity to go off on retreat, then we can still manifest a certain amount of seclusion in our lives. And that's, I think, very important for maintaining a certain amount of balance so we don't get burned out. If you have a full-on family situation going, you've got a job, career, responsibilities, all the stuff going on, it's not selfish to take an hour of the day and just say to everyone, this is my time just to be quiet. And if I can have this time every day, then I'm going to be so much more effective and joyful and in good mood and kind and patient with everyone else. So it's not selfish to take that time. And so many people, you know, are afraid to take that time because they think they're being selfish. It's not. And because there's so much in our lives now that's pulling us in the direction of complication, we really have to make a concerted effort to simplify and find that little bit of seclusion, even in the midst of a busy life, and just put a sign on the door and says, do not disturb, lock the door, just sit quietly, where you know you're not going to be disturbed, and everyone else knows that that's your quiet time. So things which are leading to seclusion are leading to the Dhamma. Now, by seclusion, the Buddha talked about three types of seclusion. One was physical seclusion. We actually take our bodies out of busy, complicated, noisy situations and put them in environments which are more solitary or remote or natural, because our environment is a powerful conditioning factor. It will make a difference in how we feel, how we experience things. So that's one level of seclusion. Another level of seclusion, which is much more profound than that, is called citta viveka. And the first is kaya viveka, so bodily seclusion. The second is citta viveka. Citta refers to the mind or heart. And when the mind or heart is secluded, this is what the Buddha meant by this, was that meditation goes so deep that it just pulls away from the world. In the same way that we might pull our body out of the mainstream of the world, the mind kind of pulls away from all of the thoughts and distractions and proliferations of our mental world, and just becomes unified, still, bright, radiant in samadhi. So that's the meaning of citta viveka. And then even more profound than that is upadhi viveka, which is seclusion from the root defilements or impurities in our heart. So even deep states of meditation will temporarily give us respite and are very powerful, but they may not be able to immediately uproot all of the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion, and all of their children. So the ultimate seclusion is seclusion from the mental defilements. The next pair is laziness and energy or effort. So anything which is leading to laziness or indolence, the Buddha said, well, this is not going to lead to the Dhamma. And anything which is, not anything, but certain things, certain types of effort are going to be leading towards the Dhamma. So this is an interesting pair to look at as well. The Buddha is clearly saying in many, many of his discourses that the Dhamma is not something which doesn't just happen. It takes a concerted effort. It takes a quality of energy. We have to give a lot putting into the Dhamma practice for it to happen, because it's like we're going upstream, going up a mountain stream in a kayak. It takes effort. One of the ways that the Buddha talked about his teaching, he didn't call it Buddhism. He had many other words for it. Sometimes he called it Dhamma Vinaya, which means the teaching and the discipline. Another term that he used was the Viryavada, which means the path of effort. It's not a path of grace. It's not a path of supplication to a deity. It's a path of personally putting forth effort, a relationship with the law of karma, so that we're putting forth effort moment by moment. But by effort, it wasn't just the idea of working hard and hard, because a lot of people work very hard and aren't lazy at all, but it's still not leading in the direction of the Dhamma. So right effort on the Noble Eightfold Path is very specific. And right effort, the Buddha didn't say, put forth lots of effort.
Right.
Meditate really hard. He said, right effort is the when negative or unwholesome states of mind arise, then we actually make the effort to do something about that. We're mindful of it, but then we make the effort to change it. And we make the effort to keep unwholesome states of mind at bay. And we make the effort to bring up wholesome states of mind. So that it's not just a hit or miss kind of a process, but we can actually make the effort to bring up contentment. We can make the effort to bring up loving kindness. We can make the effort to bring up a sense of being peaceful and bring up the causes that are going to lead to insight. And then we make the effort to sustain that. Because once it arises, then if we don't continually put forth effort into it, it passes away. You get a great meditation experience, and then somehow the clear seeing from that, if we don't keep putting effort into it, just passes away and it's gone. So that's what right effort is. So it doesn't have anything to do with specifically sitting in a cross-legged posture or doing any particular type of technique, but in every activity throughout the day, from the time we get up until the time we go to bed at night, we're able to practice meditation by practicing right effort, by watching our mental landscape, understanding, okay, what are we experiencing right now in our bodies and minds, especially in our minds, and wholesome mind states arise, then great, rejoice in that and make the effort to make them stronger, develop them, cultivate them, to make them so strong in our lives that just becomes the way that we live. The final pair is luxury and frugality. So those things which are leading towards luxury, wanting a lot, are going to be leading away from the Dhamma. Those things which are leading towards living a simple, frugal life are going to be leading towards the Dhamma. It's a very practical pair. For years I've been encouraging people to learn how to live more simply. And not just for their mental health, but also just to practice learning how to live simply, because there may be a time in the future where we don't have any choice. We're going to have to learn how to live more simply. And if we have a gradual practice of learning how to live more simply, frugally, then it's not going to be a shock. Even before I was a monk, I remember traveling in Europe, especially traveling in Asia, and then realizing while I'm traveling that, you know, I don't need very much. You start off with this huge big backpack full of everything that you're sure you're going to need, and then you start just chucking it out and saying, I don't want to carry this, I want to carry this, you know, one pair of pants, one shirt, and one toothbrush, and basically anything else you can find along the way. And I'd come back from traveling, come back with the idea that I'd always been not very materialistic anyway, but then open up my closet and there would just be rows and rows and rows of shirts and pants and pairs of shoes, and it just seemed so excessive. It was excessive, but it was normal. So that's something to reflect on. And like all these guidelines, the Buddha doesn't say, this is what it means to live simply and frugally, and this is what it means to live luxuriously, because that very much depends on the society we live on. It depends on our particular circumstances. What's frugal for a monk is not going to be frugal, or it's going to be, you know, just impractical for a lot of other people in mainstream society, and what's frugal for someone with a family and a home and a house and all of that, it would be considered very luxurious for a monk or nun. So these are guidelines for our reflection. The Buddha just kind of puts them out there, not as something to believe in blindly and to recite and as an end in itself. But he gives us these guidelines to say, use your wisdom, develop your wisdom, use your intelligence, use your common sense. Now figure out what it is in your life that is amassing and accumulating and luxurious or effort that's leading away from the Dhamma, and what are the things which are leading towards the Dhamma. And those things which are leading away from the Dhamma, then once we start to figure that out, life starts to change. Or we have the choice. And those things which are leading towards the Dhamma, then we can be confident that, yeah, this really is a good way to live. Even if we don't get a lot of support from it, from friends or family or mainstream society, you don't see a whole lot of advertisement that says, live simply. You have everything you need to be perfectly content right now. Don't buy anything more. But every situation is different. So, you know, these are things which we all have to figure out on our own. But if we are following guidelines like this, then the Buddha says that this is what will lead towards the Dhamma. This is what will lead towards true happiness, towards not just peace that arises and passes away and arises and passes away, but leads towards unshakable peace, the unshakable peace of the Dhamma. So I offer these words for your contemplation. If anyone has any questions about anything, especially about the Dhamma, please feel free to ask any questions that you like. Yes. Attention to what led up to it. Cool. That's the ninth pair. Yeah. See, there's lack of caffeine and caffeine. It's a little total sense of bliss and oneness. I feel it. My veins. Very deeply.
There's actually community. I was at a coffee shop. I was walking away from a coffee shop, but it led to a great interaction with a couple that own it. There's other people there, and kind of different legs and having community. It's like a great moment of community, and I was walking away with my coffee, feeling a great moment.
Yeah, well, that is certainly something which can bring up a lot of joy, just having a simple, positive interaction with another human being or with other people. With this whole relationship or this issue of entanglement and non-entanglement, what that means, it's related quite directly with what we mean by metta. Loving kindness, and the difference between loving with attachment and loving without attachment. Loving with attachment tends to, it has definite bliss factors with it, but it also has the seed within it which kind of leads to its own destruction if we cling too tightly. Loving without attachment is not based on a deal. It's not deal making. It's not like, well, I'll be kind to you if you're kind to me back, or I'll love you if you tell me that I'm wonderful, or you respect me, or you give me security or companionship or whatever. But just, even if you don't give me anything positive back, I'm just going to be kind and caring and loving, and then really try to do that unconditionally, which is, a very high standard. But we can gradually work towards that in our lives. And that's a way that we can live in a way that feels unburdened and unentangled, and at the same time be in the midst of relationships with other people. All sorts of different types of relationships and levels of relationships. And that gives rise to a lot of happiness. So it really comes down to getting the self out of the way. Self-interest, selfishness out of the way.
I just wanted to comment on, you spoke some about when you put yourself in situations where you just, you know, are out there without a lot of the distractions, like on retreat and stuff. I found for myself, when I came back from retreat, that I felt this like need to just let people in my life know how much they mean to me in different ways and throughout the different people. And I just had no idea what was going on. It was like I needed to let these people know how much they mean to me. And some of them were my family members. And what I found was this respect for what I was doing from my mom, basically, which was the last thing I ever thought would ever happen. And for the first time in my life, she saw that what I was doing was a good thing. And I felt like this sense of gratitude for the practice I had done. Not because I was doing it to get something, but I felt that, you know, sense of peace through that, which was really neat. So
that's
not really a question, I just wanted to share that.
Sadhu. Sadhu is the Buddhist way of saying right on. For those of you who are thinking about doing a retreat in the future, just be aware that sometimes it has the side effect of hair loss. You might have known. He didn't look like that before he started the
retreat.
Yeah, he had a good barber. No blood was drawn. It was voluntary. No one held him down. That's great to hear. Yeah, I'm really happy to hear.
You know, if you're talking about right effort, you know, the opposite being laziness and so on, so something about this isn't a path of grace or something like that. So I know these words can be used different ways, but it seems like the way I understand that word, it's like the more that we release and simplify and, you know, learn to live in harmony with nature, if there is a kind of a quality of grace that seems to become present in my experience. I don't think you were saying otherwise, but I don't know.
Right. I think you're right. People use these terms in very different ways. So I guess the way I was using the term was more in a theistic, like dualistic theistic way of essentially believing in, taking refuge in an external deity, and that external deity gives you eternal salvation through that. So the Buddha was saying that that's not how his teachings work. Yeah?
You used the word Brahma, and I was thinking, how do you map or parse these eight, you know, kind of opposite, whatever name is that you take, or duality situation against the universal experience of art, great art.
Of what?
Great art.
Great art.
Great art, you know, whether it's dance or music or literature, painting. all of them seem to have, maybe this is a Western inspiration, a lot of tension. But it's a great Michelangelo piece of art, so great piece of literature like Shakespeare, one of Gwyn's dance. I mean, there's a lot of tension there.
Tension? Wins dancing?
So you look at maybe she might not be great for that, or she could put it on the choreography. So you have all these cultural artifacts.
That's what makes great art. You know, relationship, relaxation, tension, and release.
You got it. So I look at all the examples of my head because some culture is really important to me. So I'm trying to map these eight. Duality, what you're talking about, it means great art, human experience in East Western society, what great art is.
Well, art, or great art, even bad art, is just such a huge category. But as a general thing, you can take these guidelines, these standards, and look at art with those eight standards, for example. You know, is this leading towards entanglement? Or is it leading toward accumulation of art? I think where these standards would really come into play is in the creation of art. Like for the artist herself or himself, and our relationship with art, or just the art of life, and how we relate with life. But the way we relate to it, is it leading towards these, say, wholesome qualities of, you know, letting go and the coolness of dispassion and freedom? And that really, you can't make a statement either one way or the other. It really depends on how we relate to it. Even one work of art may bring up a sense of freedom and letting go for one person who watches it or looks at it or experiences it, and then the next person might feel it might just bring up totally different stuff from within their mind that is holding an attachment or angst or tension or whatever. So I guess really these standards are more about our relationship, how we are in relationship with the things in our life. Depends what you mean by that.
Oh, well, some kinds of relationships are more complicated than others.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, if the heart's involved and all of that. And anyhow, but does that mean if things get messy, you need to back off? And let all the threads untangle and say, okay, you know, let's just keep this at arm's distance. I'll never be even a halfway decent Buddhist 5 minutes a day if I'm, you know, perturbed like this. Or is there room for it?
Okay, well, you bring up many different issues, and there's no one pat answer. You have to kind of feel, okay, this level of entanglement, emotional, pulling on the heartstrings, the kind of the play between passion and dispassion, or holding on and disappointment, and you know, or a real sense of kind of happiness or bliss, and then the fear of losing that, and people's personalities, and changing moods. Now, you don't just escape that by going into a monastery. In many ways, you have to confront it, because suddenly you're thrown into a situation where you're not just in a relationship with, you know, a partner, a man or a woman, but you're in a relationship with a whole community of, in my case, guys who, you know, we never would have chosen on our own to live together. You know, we're all from different cultures and different personalities, and in many ways very different. But, you know, the thing which we have in common was the Dhamma, or the willingness to use the Dhamma in a way that we can be in harmony. In the social sense, in relationship with each other. And community life is a big part of our training. Being in solitude and meditating and off in nature, that's very important. And going back into community and being with other people and getting feedback from other people, that's very important too. And so we're always in relationship. Even hermits are in a relationship. They still kind of have to deal with people or animals or something. They're always in relationship with something. So it really comes down to how we're in relationship with things. Now, if you have very intimate relationships that can be much more intense or give rise to a lot more intensity of emotion, but basically the same principles apply. Learning how to live harmoniously with other people's personalities and fluctuations and idiosyncrasies. Trying to move away from just loving the people that we like and not liking the people we don't like. Just moving towards a general appreciation of, say, if you're in a really kind of a intimate partnership relationship, then try to move towards a spaciousness of appreciation that can encompass even the times when other people are in a bad mood or are not quite giving us what we want. So there's a lot of Dhamma practice to be had in there, depending on if we're approaching it from the viewpoint of, you know, these helpful guidelines. And when we need to kind of go into it more or back off or whatever, that kind of depends on how much mindfulness we have. If we have very strong, spacious awareness and attentiveness to what's happening, we can be in the midst of very complicated situations. Maybe busy, noisy, a lot of things happening. Just a lot of going on externally and internally. But if there's like spacious mindfulness around it, then it can all be seen as Dhamma practice. We can all be seen as things which are arising, passing away. You know, we don't have to get drawn into it in a negative sense. You know, we're kind of living it. At the same time, we're not a slave to it all. We don't get totally hoodwinked by everything. But if we don't have mindfulness that's strong enough, when things start to get too intense, it's like we lose it. We kind of lose perspective. You know, we don't get what we want, we're really upset, and emotions just can go all over the place. And if that starts to happen, then that may be a sign that, okay, maybe we should back off a little bit. To the degree that you can kind of have a spaciousness around situations, then that's a sign that, okay, relationship, the amount of entanglement is sort of within our ability to handle.
Thank
you. Probably time for one more question. Somebody has a last question.
Okay, two questions. Hands went up simultaneously. I have to go with Anne first. By the way, Anne, we all sent our metta, loving kindness, to you at the closing ceremony. So I hope you felt it.
I felt it.
Okay, good.
My question would be last because I would like to hear about your future plans.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. All right. Do you want to go first then?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, my time in Minneapolis is actually coming a bit to a close. I just arrived, but it's coming to a close. Tomorrow I go down to Northfield, which is where I went to college, went to Carleton. And so when I come into this area, it's nice to be able to go down, visit my old alma mater, and see some of my religion professors, people that I used to hold up as, you know, some of my religion professors were a bit like demigod status, and now they consider me an honored guest, so you're fine. So, and so I majored in religion, so I was one who made good in his major. and also it's really encouraging because now there's a Buddhist organization, Buddhist society right there on the main street of Northfield, which we never had that when I was a student. So tomorrow I'm going down to Northfield, spending the day down there teaching, giving talks. Then the next day I go to Rochester, and midday I give a talk at Mayo Clinic, then in the evening I give a talk at Doug's Vipassana group. Is it Rochester Vipassana? Good guess. Okay. And then Friday I'll come back here. I'll be staying here Friday, but be visiting some of my relatives who are still here in the Minneapolis area. And then Saturday morning, go back to San Jose to visit my mother for a couple of days, and then back to New Zealand on the 28th.
And so maybe the clarified question was, are you going to return to Minnesota, and is there some future movement on some of your other activities in that day?
Well, it depends. Do you think anyone would be interested in doing another one of those wilderness courses? If there's enough interest to rough it up in the Northern Lake Country again next year, John is really happy. John was the owner of the cabin, his old family friend. And he was very impressed with how wonderful and kind and loving all these Buddhists were. Totally new to him. He didn't know what to expect. And after a couple of days, he said, you know, there's just so much positive energy coming off of these people. No negativity whatsoever, you know. So he says, you know, we can definitely come back and do it again there if there's enough interest. And if there's enough interest, then I'm happy to do it again.
Sounds like yes. Thank you so much for your time, Paul.
Cookies?
No, but we have juice.
Okay.
We have juice for people if you'd like to stay. And I just like to remind people that at the end of the talk, after having received the teachings and shared in Ajahn Chandoka's practice, we can support him and support the center by leaving a donation. And when we have a guest teacher at the center, we share half of the donations with the guest teacher and save half for the support of the operation of the center. And maybe this is in part what Anne was referring to. The donations that are left for Ajahn Chandoka, the part that goes for him, being a monk, he's often taken care of, or he doesn't get taken care of, if no one is doing it. So this money isn't going to go to his IRA, or 401k, but it's going to be dedicated to building a meditation cabin. It's called a kuti, up on John's land. And if conditions arise, the little cabin will appear, and Ajahn Chandoka will have a place to practice when he's in Minnesota for however long that is. And if things turn out, we'll be able to practice with him up there if things work out. So we'll see how it goes. If you're interested in that project, knowing more about it, you can send us an email and I'll forward it to Ajahn Chandoka, and you can get involved in making that little meditation cabin happen. Also, we have our own building that we're working on, and it's an exciting time. Lots is happening. And if you're not on David's new building volunteer list, David Alsestein, our project manager, has his name and his email address on the far wall in the entranceway. You can just take that, send him an email, and you get a weekly reminder of what our schedule of when you can come and help put in the floor or do some painting. Or we'll be doing some gardening around the building as soon as the new stucco is up in another week or so. So lots happening, making some progress. And if most likely we'll be serving Ajahn Chandoka a meal on Saturday morning, probably around 10:30, thereabouts. If you're interested in that, you can let me know. You can bring some food for the meal, or you can just come and join us for the meal. So just let me know if you'd like to join in. And if you have some time tonight to help put away the cushions and chairs, that would be great. And we're also looking for a program host for the monthly evening Dharma program, where we have guest speakers, people to come early, set up, make sure things get put away, answer questions. So if you've been around in the community for a while and you want to commit to coming, not necessarily every month, but several months out of the year at the monthly evening program that we sponsor, let me know. That would be great. Any other announcements for the community that people have? So maybe we can end in this traditional way. You heard Ajahn Chandoka use the word sadhu. So it's traditional after somebody gives a talk that you've appreciated and feel like they've said things in a way that makes sense and can be useful in your life. And you say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So three times you say that together if you want to join me.
Sadhu, sadhu.